I'm from Kotzebue, Alaska. I represent where all the oil comes from in the North Slope. My name is John Davies. I represent the west part of Fairbanks. It's the area that encompasses the university up there.
Representative Ben Grusendorf, District 2, Sitka, Wrangell, Petersburg, and Kuprianov.
Lauren Lehman, I serve in the State Senate. My district is especially northwest Anchorage.
Senator Bershark, East of Fairbanks, Fort Wainwright, and from Anchorage.
Senator John Ferguson, the Kenai Peninsula, and we have a little bit of oil on our.
Representative Pete Kelly from the east side of Fairbanks.
Representative Gary Davis, Kenai Peninsula, District 8, from Soldotna to Seward, in the House of Representatives.
Did we miss anybody else? Oh,
Representative Carl Moses, District 40, where most of the fish come from.
Anybody else?
Representative Alan Kemplin, from the neighborhoods of Fairview, Mountain View, and Anchor.
Representative Eric Croft,
I'm Randy Phillips. I represent Eagle River, which is a small community in northeast Anchorage, third largest city in the state, and Fort Rich, as well as East Anchorage. First of all, we want to go ahead and welcome the Permanent Fund Board and the asset managers who will be giving us a capital markets outlook for 1998. I believe Byron Malott, who is the executive director for the Permanent Fund, will go ahead and take over the show here. And before you say anything, I would like just I talked to one of your fellows here, just to keep it free flowing, and it doesn't have to be all that structured. Don't worry about you got to do everything precisely right. So we just want to just get a free flowing discussion. We'll just go from there, and we'll just play it by ear as time goes on. We do have a 9 o'clock finance meeting, but we're operating on SST time, standard time. So,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Byron Malott. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. With me are members of the investment staff of the fund, as well as the Permanent Fund Board of Trustees. Chairman Eric Walforth is with us, as well as each member. We would like to thank you for this opportunity to present a capital markets outlook. We begin our process at the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation of determining asset allocation for the following year as part of a three-year rolling strategic planning process that is how we determine ultimately how the assets of the fund are invested. The fact that within a few years it is likely that the earnings of the Alaska Permanent Fund, unless there are significant sea changes, will exceed the revenue flowing from oil into the state coffers overall, we believe, as we have discussed with you, that it is appropriate that the principal elected policy, public policy leaders of our state understand capital markets. And so we have begun this process, and we appreciate your allowing us to do that. I would like to introduce Michael O'Leary from Callan and Associates, who is the Permanent Fund's principal investment consultant. Michael has worked with the fund for at least a decade. He has as one of his principal responsibilities advising and counseling the Board of Trustees as they establish their asset allocation policies. And in the interest of time, I'd like to introduce Mr. O'Leary and ask him to proceed. So, thank you, Senator.
Good morning, all. I'm delighted to be here, and I'm going to moderate the panel. We have a very distinguished panel, I know that you will value their views. Just to set a framework, there's a slide up here that depicts Callan's 1998 five-year projections. And they range from about a little bit more than 9% for the S&P 500 and and 6.6% for domestic bonds. International stocks being a little bit higher than domestic large cap stocks at 9.6%, and small cap domestic stocks a little bit over 10%. All of these numbers are lower than the five-year numbers that we had last year. The principal reason for that is the inflation number is lower, and interest rates today are much lower than they were last year. So these are the assumptions that in setting asset allocation policy with the board, we will be discussing. And this yesterday was the first time that the board saw these new projections. We wanted to have them up here so that you have a frame of reference for the panelists' remarks. John Triano will be our first speaker. He is the chief executive of Schroeder Capital Management International. Schroeder's manages a Pacific Basin portfolio for the permanent fund. And obviously Southeast Asia is dominating the financial news. So we're going to start with him. He'll be followed by Charlie Edsel, who is managed money, a U.S. Large cap value portfolio for the permanent fund for 15 years, Charlie. Then Bill McCoy from Sanford Bernstein will discuss the bond market. And Peter Aldridge will give you a perspective on real estate. And as each speaker begins, I'll give you a little bit of their background. But John, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you very much. Just before I start, I'll see if we can't get my slides just lined up. But while we're waiting for that, good morning. And by way of introduction, in the next 5 minutes, really what I'm going to seek to cover is a review of Asia and also the emerging markets more broadly, because one of the plans being studied in the permanent fund is a broadening of our mandate to include emerging markets overall. And I think really in those 5 minutes, I want to try and answer three questions. The first is why the crisis in Asia developed. The second is what is the outlook going forward for these markets, because a lot of focus is what's happened in the past. And finally, we've been asked to quantify our expectations for returns for the specific asset classes of PAC Basin, ex-Japan, and emerging markets. Now, as a starting point, although I'm going to spend most of my time talking about Asia, I thought it was worth looking at the emerging markets overall. And one of the things that's worth pointing out is that these markets don't only include Asia. It includes Latin America, it includes Eastern Europe, it includes South Africa, and indeed the rest of the African continent. It includes Israel. And it really is a collection of very broad markets that are the younger and more developing countries in the world. Now, what this chart basically shows is the performance of those markets over the long run. And the important thing it shows is that they have provided good long-run returns. And that's absolutely crucial, because the arguments for investing in these markets is that they should be capable of delivering strong returns to the Alaska Permanent Fund. Now, if you look at the very recent past, you can clearly see that the markets have actually fallen. And that really is a function of what has been happening in Asia. So what I'd like to really do now is spend a couple of minutes just looking at how the crisis in Asia actually developed. Oh, thank you very much. In many ways, the roots of the crisis were actually set in the region's previous success and its very rapid growth over many years. Thailand was actually the seat of this problem. This is a country that had managed to grow its economy at close to 8% for 10 years. And as that growth came through, one of the things that happens in a country like Thailand is that you end up getting excesses developing in certain areas. Real estate prices, for example, rise. Consumers spend a lot of money and the trade deficit starts to increase. And banks find it easy to lend money and the credit's freely available. Now, in countries where you see very rapid growth and these excesses starting to build, it's absolutely crucial that the government takes a policy response that addresses these things, that seeks to cool the economy down, that seeks to take out the easy credit. And that was really what was lacking in the case of Thailand. Those policy actions weren't taken. Now, what ultimately happened was that the markets themselves took control of the situation, particularly the currency markets. And essentially, because of selling of the Thai currency both by foreigners and by Thai residents, that currency was forced to devalue. And it really devalued in a very disorderly manner, because once its link to the dollar was broken, there was no natural next level for it to go to. And it's been that disorderly devaluation that has really led to the economic dislocation that you're reading about every day in your newspapers. Now, if the problem had been restricted solely to Thailand, I don't think this would have been a very big deal, and it certainly wouldn't have been making front page news in the US. But the last and perhaps most damaging component of the equation is that these currency pressures spread to a number of other countries very rapidly, and it affected Malaysia, Indonesia, the Philippines, and lastly Korea, all of which suffered very rapid currency devaluations, just like Thailand did. These pressures also affected countries with much better economic fundamentals, countries like Singapore, Hong Kong, and Taiwan, all of whom have much more robust economies and have little reason for their currencies to devalue in that way. So it was this cycle, really, of excessive growth, excess, rapidly sliding currencies, and contagion to other countries that have led us to the Asian crisis that we have today. Now, that's how the crisis developed. Where do we stand now? And I'd encourage you to ask questions.
Can you just say a little bit more about what was the reason for the contagion? What was the linkage?
Well, the interesting thing is a number of those other countries also had problems that arose from excess from too rapid growth. The interesting thing is that there's a lot of generalizations about Asia, and everything is grouped together. In many ways, each of the countries had different problems. Korea's problem, which is the most serious in a way because of the size of its economy, and also it's the most serious from the point of view of the United States because of the relationship with Korea and the political importance of the country. Its problem was actually private sector debt. The interesting thing is the Korean government has very little debt as of now, but the private sector has a very large amount of debt, and that, in a way, was the thing that caused people to lose confidence in Korea. Interestingly, in Indonesia, the problem was foreign debt and too much short-term foreign debt that needed to be repaid. And one of the interesting things is that when confidence is withdrawn for a period, the amounts of money that these countries need to borrow in the short run may not be very large in terms of the size of their absolute economies, but if the capital is not available, the prices get pushed down very rapidly. And so the five countries that were affected, a sort of analogy is that Thailand is the house that's on fire and these are other houses on the block. Well, the ones that were most flammable did catch fire. The real issue going forward is what happens to places like Singapore and Hong Kong, which have no reason to. They can feel the heat, and they shouldn't catch fire, and we don't believe they will. But that's how the contagion went through. And it's very interesting because of all the things that I think have surprised commentators and asset managers and debt rating agencies, because one of the big issues is why, you know, didn't Moody's and the other these people who have now downgraded these countries know that there were these problems? It's that element of contagion and the systematic lack of confidence across these countries that I think has taken people by surprise. So the next question really is, where are we now in these countries? And really I'm talking here from a capital market perspective, and I think there are two points that I would really stress. If you look at in terms of the declines in the currency markets, the decline in the capital markets have taken place, roughly half the losses have occurred as a result of currency depreciation, and half the losses have occurred because the stock markets have gone down. And I think as of today, one can make two very strong statements. The first is that the currencies are cheap in these countries, and the second is that the stocks are cheap in these countries. Now, why do I say the currencies are cheap? Most studies of what is a fair value for a currency rest on saying, well, if a country can sustain a trade surplus, then it's, i.e., it can export more than it imports, then by definition its currency must be competitive. It was one of the problems in these Asian countries because they were running deficits. Now, if you look back last year, you can see the Korean won, which is the example I have here, was trading at 900, and it had a significant trade deficit. You can see the tremendous swing that's taking place this year. The currency has roughly halved, and we expect the country to be in a substantial trade surplus this year. The same is true for a number of the other markets. So I think there's pretty strong evidence that the currencies in this area have overshot and are now cheap on a long-run basis. The other thing is that the stocks also are cheap after the market decline. And here we're showing a number of stocks. Philippines long-distance telephone is in one of the countries that has been affected by the contagion. India is a country that hasn't been affected by it. It's a huge country. And finally, Telebrás is the telephone company in Brazil. But you can see that in each case, on this year's price-earnings ratios, and I'll explain in simple terms what that means, you can find high rates of growth for relatively modest price-earnings ratios. And a price-earnings ratio is simply saying, how many years of earnings am I having to pay to buy this company? And to give you an analogy with the US market, for those sorts of rates of growth, you would roughly be paying twice to three times the valuations in these countries. So I would argue that both the currencies and the stocks are cheap as of today. Now, it's all very well to say that, but one of the things that one soon finds out in financial markets is that just because something's cheap, it doesn't mean it won't stay cheap. So the next question really is, what will it take for these markets to recover, and how will they turn around? And on this slide, really, I'm setting forth the three things that we feel are really important that need to take place before these stock markets can recover. Now, the first thing is that the currencies have to stabilize, because once the devaluations took place, these currencies headed down precipitately and really very rapidly. Now, one of the things here is, having said that the currencies are very inexpensive, that doesn't matter in the short run, because what determines the value of the currency is the level at which people are happy to buy and sell it today, and it's capital flows that are determining the currency level today. And what it takes is to find a level where the local inhabitants and local companies who are the main sellers of their currencies at the moment can find a balance with people who find enough value in them to buy them. And I would argue that this first step is quite possibly taking place right now. All the currencies are currently off their lows. Something like the Korean won today was trading at 1,550 against a low of 1,800. Now, it's certainly not to say that they couldn't retest them or that something else could happen out there, but there are signs that we are actually seeing this very important first stage actually taking place now. Now, once the currencies stabilize, that allows the next piece of the puzzle to really fall into place, which is that interest rates need to fall, because the economies and the financial sectors need relief from very high real interest rates. And the real interest rates are high to try and stop these currencies falling. So as soon as they manage to find their level, one's going to find that it's possible for interest rates in these countries to start to come down.
Could you give us some idea of the level of interest rates there?
Yeah, well, if you look in Indonesia today, for example, interest rates are around 25% in the short run. In some countries, they're still quite low, like Malaysia, they're closer to 10% and they're being held there. But in most of the countries that are in distress, the interest rates are in the high 20s. Now, against inflation currently that's, you know, high single digits, obviously that is going to rise because of what's happened, but those are very high real interest rates. And clearly when those rates start to come down, the last leg of the puzzle is that will provide a release of the pressure that's on the financial sector and the banking sectors in these countries, and it will also allow the economies to start to expand again. Now, clearly, it's not going to be even, and the places that are going to recover first are the export sectors, because many of these countries have become a lot more competitive as a result of the decline in their currencies. Other parts of the economy, like the consumer, are going to need to be very slow for some time. But that's really the cycle that we see needing to fall into place. And at the moment, we're at what we would say is stage one, or at least we believe we are. The final thing that I would talk to is that we've been asked to put firm projections on our expected returns, and set out here are the expected returns both for Asia ex-Japan, which is the portfolio we're currently running, as well as emerging markets, which is the projected expansion of our mandate. And I put this slide up with some trepidation because there's nothing more frightening in a volatile asset class than being asked to put a single figure on a piece of paper as to the returns you're likely to generate. But what I would say is that we believe these are very conservative projections, and that the Asian markets are very capable of producing 20% a year growth both for the next 12 months but also for each of the next 5 years. And to put it in the context of where those markets have come from, that 20% one-year return would recoup less than a fifth of the decline. So you can see that's not an aggressive forecast of what the markets are capable of producing. And the emerging markets more generally, as you can see, we would expect to produce a return which, if you relate it to Michael O'Leary's projections for international equities, also show superior returns. And clearly, that is a reflection of the fact that we've been through a period, as you saw from that first chart, of a cyclically poor period of returns for the last 4 years. So from the point of view of the consideration of the timing of what is really the permanent fund's first exposure in that area, that also seems to be very timely.
Thank you, John. We'll come back with a host of questions, but we'll move ahead to Charlie, who's the vice chairman of ARK Asset Management. And as I said earlier, Charlie has been managing personally the permanent funds portfolio managed by ARK since its inception, and he'll focus on the U.S. stock market. Without further ado, Charlie, it's all yours.
Okay, well, thank you, Michael, and enjoyable always to be in Juneau and meeting with our friends at the Permanent Fund. My task today is to give an outlook for the U.S. economy and stock market. I'm glad that my colleague on my right has taken care of the PAC REM, because obviously that's the topic that is of great interest in fashioning an outlook for the U.S. economy and stock market. Are you gonna? Yeah. Okay. As we enter this year, one of the biggest positives in formulating an outlook for the U.S. economy and market is that the U.S. economy moved into this PAC REM crisis in excellent shape. Despite the fact that the economic expansion had been going on since 1991, we're moving into the eighth year, growth had been moderate but steady. It had been well sustained. It had not developed great excesses. And the outlook going forward prior to these events in the PAC REM was a very positive and solid outlook. This is very important in that the U.S. economy, which is very, very large in relation to quantifying these problems, offsetting it in the PAC REM and global trade, and the momentum is like having a large aircraft carrier moving, and to disturb its course takes quite a shock. So as a result, those are kind of opening comments that we approach this year in forecasting with a positive general outlook. Now, of course, concerns of the moment, the Asia crisis and its impact on the U.S. economy and the equity markets. On the next page, picked out a few issues to talk about that relate to the Asia crisis. Oversupply of goods and pressures on prices and what have you. Obviously, as John pointed out, the PAC REM is going to be looking to be exporting more. Their currency values have come down. They're going to be able to export at lower prices, and the U.S. is going to be one of the major buyers of these products. In other words, we're going to have a larger flow of goods coming into the United States next in 98 and going forward that will be at lower prices, attractive prices? I mean, we all know when you go to a retailer where all these shirts and items are made, and they're generally in countries where their currencies have gone down, and we're going to enjoy lower prices. But in general, this is going to put pressure across our economy on prices. This is good for Mr. Greenspan and monetary policy because the concerns about inflation are being further dampened going forward and has allowed for a very meaningful rally and decline in our interest rates, especially on the long end in the United States, which is benefiting the consumer's balance sheet. There's a great deal of activity in refinancing mortgages to lower levels, which leaves more in the consumer's pocket, et cetera. And these are powerful forces in the near term. They're going to help the U.S. economy continue to move forward at offsetting the economic effects of these shocks. We hear comments of the word deflation because of this pressure on prices. Deflation has a number of definitions, but certainly the most dangerous one, and the one we don't even think is on the radar screen, is where you get into a situation like the 1930s, where you have declining real asset prices, real estate, financial asset prices, and it topples the financial system. This is not the case the United States faces. We face more pressure on inflation in a downward mode, which is a disinflationary trend. This has actually been going on and has been benefiting our financial markets and the economy since the early 1980s. Interest rates have, as I mentioned earlier, have come down. The long Treasury bond, which in early 1987 had moved up above 7%, is now comfortably under 6%. A great deal of this move has taken place since October, when the Pac Rim situation became much more serious and in the headlines. This is a powerful force in maintaining an attractive background for the valuation of all financial instruments, having the interest rates go down, and especially maintaining an underpinning for the valuation of common stocks. Looking domestically, household debt, our economy is made up of two-thirds by the consumer, so obviously the health of the average consumer is always of interest. We have gone through a year where a number of the credit card issuing companies, the Visas, the Sears card, what have you, the bank cards, there has been a continued rise this year, not to alarming levels, but it's moving in a negative direction of bad debts and higher levels of consumer credit. I would say that these trends are normal for a growing economy. The level of household debt is not at critical levels as long as the economy continues to move in a positive fashion. Obviously, if all forecasts were wrong and we moved into a recession, the consumer then retrenches, and it has a very meaningful effect on consumer spending. But at the moment, that doesn't appear to be the trend or the outcome that's likely to take place this year. Stock market dynamics, getting to the bottom line for the equity market. I think it's very important to look at the trends that have been driving the markets. Maybe we can flip to the next page, and that gives a perspective of the returns that we've been enjoying in the U.S. market over the last 10 years. The markets, as measured by the large cap indices, the S&P 500, has compounded at 18.1%. This has been a phenomenal period. Only one down year, a very modest down year in 1990. And rates of return that are more like emerging markets projections of 18% a year. Now, in the middle of the graph, you can see over the period, very long period of time, 1926 through 1997, the returns in the markets have been 11% a year. Certainly very attractive returns, but much less than the most recent 10-year period. And over on the right-hand side, you can see it has even been better in the recent period, 3 years, 5 years, 7 years. So we have had a very phenomenal period here in the U.S. equity markets. And it is our contention with the background of the U.S. economy that we should look positive to expectations in 1998, but certainly mute the expectations compared to recent experience. Now, just a few items that have been driving the markets, because I think they're very important to assess whether these trends are still moving in the right direction, even though certainly some of their magnitudes of positive effects are less than they were in the early period. The profits of the U.S. Corporations have gone through a very strong period in this economic cycle since 1990. Even though GDP has grown at more moderate rates than prior economic cycles, U.S. companies' profits have grown at a very much more dramatic rate. And in the 5-year period, profits have gone up more than 120%. This by a magnitude of 50% is a greater sustained profit move by corporate America than we've experienced in any other prior economic expansion since World War II. So this has been a very strong driving force in producing these high rates of return in the equity markets. As I mentioned, that the economy has been growing moderately, continuously, without great imbalances since the early 1990s, and this has been a strong force in producing a background for good equity returns. A new element in this decade compared to prior decades has been a meaningful shift in the average household's investments and interest in the equity market. This really began in 1990 when the short-term interest rates were brought down to rekindle an advance in our economy. As we all remember, it was very comfortable during the high inflation and high interest rate period to have a money market fund, and it earned 9, 10, 11%. Lo and behold, we found out in 1990 short-term rates had been brought down to 3%, and you didn't get much income. The U.S. equity market had been producing good returns since the early 1980s, and the public rediscovered equities for their savings. And what has happened is the average household's financial asset balance sheet has doubled their exposure from 16 to 37% in equities during this period of time. And they have done this by taking old and new savings and have, as we know reading the papers, funneling it through mainly the mutual fund industry, and the flows that have been coming in along with corporations more and more adopting 401ks has been a very powerful force in the supply-demand dynamics for equities, along with the activity by corporate America, that where there has been a lot of takeover activity. A lot of activity in this takeover has been for cash that removes supply of equities. And also, corporations have tend to favor stock buybacks versus aggressive increases in dividends. And this has provided very strong supply-demand dynamics. Interest rates and inflation during this cycle. 1989-90, the long-term Treasury bond was trading around 8%. As I say now, it's under 6. This is a very powerful force in propping up values of competitive financial instruments, being stocks. The inflation bogey in 1990, it had come down considerably from the early 80s, but it was around 5% last year. The CPI was 2.2. A very meaningful factor in providing high valuations for equities, but also providing more real savings for the consumer and disposable income. So these trends, which have been positive, you could say, looking forward at this point in time, are being threatened by current events in the PAC rim, and or they have played out their major shift like the household savings, but they're all still trending in a positive direction, and I think will continue to provide dynamic support to producing a positive return in expectations from the equity market in the years ahead. I've kind of, in summary, the 1988 outlook, I've tried to take kind of a broad consensus from the financial market of what the bullish prognosticators are looking for, the bearish, and they're somewhat confusing in the bearish comments, because I would put aside, and there is not really serious forecasting going on of putting a recession into the U.S. economic outlook and its effect on the stock market. So the more bearish commentators and forecasting is that the U.S. economy is doing so well, it grows too fast and creates stresses and strains and rises in interest rates and inflation, which puts pressure on valuations of stocks and bonds and produces a more negative environment than a more slower, steady growth, which is the more bullish scenario, a maintenance of growth in the economy, no real meaningful upward pressure from inflation, good levels of interest rates producing reasonable earnings growth. Earnings growth is going to be pressured by these competitive prices coming in from overseas. Profit margins of corporate America are going to be under pressure, but the outlook is still for positive gains in earnings and rates of return for stocks as we go through 1998. Certainly with the element of greatest concern being the PAC rim, the market is expected to be much more volatile this year because there's going to be items of news that come in from overseas that are going to disturb the market. The market's highly sensitive to earnings and effects on earnings because it carries a very high valuation after this long period of superior returns. And so it is going to be a much more volatile year, but I think one that will turn out in the positive column, certainly much less than we've enjoyed, but still moving in a positive direction.
Thank you, Charlie. Bill McCoy is a senior portfolio manager with Sanford Bernstein. Sanford Bernstein is a bond and one of the external domestic bond managers for the permanent fund, and the firm currently has a fairly cautious investment posture, and it's important that we always see the other side of the market. So, Bill?
Oh, we give just a second for...
Can I ask a question of Charlie?
Certainly.
Sure. One of the reasons that John knew that we had good evaluations for emerging markets was by comparing it to the U.S. saying you get...
Well, no.
That yeah. Means one of two things, it seems to me. Either we're horribly overvalued or they're under.
Or that you need a risk premium, in other words, lower values for the greater uncertainties that are by investing in an emerging market versus the more safe big battleship but is not as dynamic economy of the U.S.
I hasten to add, I don't think those companies should trade at the same multiples as U.S. stocks, and then exactly for the reason Charlie says, you need a risk premium to invest there. I was only drawing the analogy to give you some feel for the magnitude of how you were valuing those earnings, but relative to something that you'll be far more familiar with.
Well, but there's some other reasons to think that we're at historically high price earnings ratios in the United States. So whatever the analysis there, are we overvalued in the U.S. market?
Well, certainly if you look at history of the financial markets, we are very highly valued in the United States. And I kind of enunciated a number of reasons why we are. Things have turned out very, very good. And we have still declining inflation. We have moderate pressure on interest rates, which are really trending down. And these are all very positive forces in jacking up the valuation of what equities should sell for. If that environment greatly changes, valuation is at risk in the U.S. market, as it would be in any market. But at the moment, it is hard to argue with that the valuations are high. Expectations of returns going forward should be much less than we have experienced, but certainly the underlying trends, fundamental trends, support a positive outlook.
Or so says ARC, but now we'll hear Burns.
Thank you. I'd like to thank you all for inviting us here to speak before you today. And what I'd like to talk about is what we see as some of the more one of the most compelling distortions in the fixed income markets, that is the complacency of U.S. investors to the risks of rising inflation. We think this complacency is particularly unwarranted given the low U.S. unemployment rate and the rising wage inflation currently happening. However, on the other side, this complacency is due to the belief that we are now in a new economic era, that the rules of the economy have changed, and it will be possible to have strong GDP growth, low unemployment, and consequently low inflation. And I'm not disagreeing with Charlie that inflation over this time period has declined, but it's important to point out that most of this decline has occurred in goods deflation, which is a decreasing component of the U.S. economy. As you can see on the next slide, we think that three components have been responsible for this very nice decline in goods inflation. First, since 1995, the dollar has risen over 20% versus its major trading partners, making the import basket of goods that much cheaper for the U.S. consumer. And you can see in the top chart how drastically the price of imports goods has declined in the U.S. Second, with unemployment now so low, that is, we are at the lowest unemployment rate since the Vietnam War and the lowest peacetime unemployment rate, that while earnings have been rising, companies have been able to keep a lid on their total compensation costs due to the aggressive use of HMOs. The HMOs have come into market to gain market share, have been aggressively cutting prices. The effect has been medical benefits and employee benefit costs have declined substantially. And in those instances where wages and compensation have risen at about a 4% rate, companies have had a 2% offset due to a surge in productivity in the last several years, so that they only have to raise their prices 2% to be able to maintain their profit margins. Where we disagree with the markets is that while some attribute this to a permanent change in the economy, we believe that this is temporary. As you can see on the next slide, at some point, the turmoil in Asia will subside, the dollar will stabilize, and we will stop having this positive benefit of import goods so that inflation will start to rise again, or will at least have less of a positive benefit. Second, due to the well-publicized problems in employee benefits and the HMO costs, they have had to start raising their prices. Our healthcare analysts report that service contracts being signed for 98, 99, and going forward have had significant price increases. And while one number doesn't make a trend, the employment cost index that was released has also confirmed the start of this rise. So this could go from being a positive to actually a negative on rising inflation going forward. And finally, when you look at the productivity trend, way down in the lower right-hand corner, that up blip is, yes, the surge in productivity we've had over the past several years. But as you can see, we are in a decades-long trend of 1% productivity growth, making this productivity quite likely to be, A, not sustainable, or B, we think actually likely to be revised down. Thus, with these pressures leaving the positive aspects of the story, we expect the underlying inflation rate to start to rise. In some sense, we believe this will catch market participants by surprise because of the complacency, as well as the Fed. When they start to see the signs of rising inflation appear in the market, they will step in, do their job, and raise interest rates. And that very simply is the story. Thank you.
Bill, let's put a number on it.
Okay.
The long-term Treasury bond today is at what, roughly?
Just under 6%.
Just under 6%. Where would you expect that bond to be a year from now?
In similar environments, when inflation has started to rise and the Fed has stepped in and started raising rates, it would not be uncommon to see it 7.5% to 8%. That is 150 to 200 basis point rise.
And Charlie, if that sort of rise occurred, what would you think of the stock market outlook?
I think it would indicate that more more pressures had developed. The interest rate rise would very meaningfully affect the valuation structure of equities, and we could suffer a decline in the equity market, which is not unheard of having a correction of up to 20%.
On that happy note,
we'll shift to an asset category that probably won't move all that much in the next 12 months.
But one that has been producing very attractive returns of late, and that is real estate. The permanent fund has a target allocation of 10% for real estate. Currently, it's a little bit over 6% invested in real estate. Our next speaker is Peter Aldridge, who's a founder and is a co-chairman, Peter, of AEW, a real estate advisor in Boston. He has a very impressive resume, and I encourage you to read the biography. But in the interest of time, I'll turn it to Peter.
Thank you very much, Michael. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here. I'll try to be brief. We say real estate's now a no-brainer. It's not always that way.